Radio, your gamer's role.
www.d20radio.com. Hello and welcome to the Knowledge Check Podcast, a 5th edition D&D discussion podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric, and this is a special episode of the Knowledge Check Podcast, as you can probably tell because 1, Philip's not here, and 2, it is a Monday. Now we are going to be releasing our normally scheduled episode tomorrow, like we do every other Tuesday. Philip and I discuss Warlocks on that episode and kind of break down that class, but I wanted to release a special episode today for all of you, giving you my review of Tales of the Yawning Portal, which is the latest book from Wizards of the Coast, and it takes a lot of old-school D&D dungeons from editions in the past and adapts them into 5e mechanics, which is something I absolutely love. I did this anyway on my own. I love going back and reading advanced D&D adventures or 3rd edition or even 4th edition dungeons and adapting them and pulling ideas from those things into my campaign in 5th edition. Now, something that surprised me about this book is it actually has kind of a loose narrative connecting the dungeons together. I say loose narrative, and I mean that very loose, because don't go into this expecting Storm King's Thunder or Out of the Abyss. This is definitely a book of separate dungeons that they have adapted, but they do provide you a loose means to connect all of them if you want to run this book like a campaign, which is totally doable. They have leveled it to where you can start with the Sunless Citadel at first level, and the end of your campaign is Tomb of Horrors, which is probably the end of your campaign in more ways than one. But I just want to break down the book for you, go through each dungeon, tell you what I think they did well, what they could have done better, and most importantly, what you can pull from this book to make your campaigns that much better. So first off, the introduction, which do not skip the introduction. First off, the table of contents has page numbers for each of the maps throughout the book, which I think is awesome. I love this because if you need to pull up a map real quick from the Sunless Citadel, you're not flipping through that dungeon trying to find the map. You can go to the table of contents, see that it's on page number X, and flip straight to it. Also, it gives you a straightforward description of each dungeon. So if you're just going into this book trying to find some inspiration, you can look at each of these and kind of figure out flavor-wise which one would be the best place for you to start. But the highlight of the introduction for me is the Yawning Portal Tavern. That's where the book gets its name, is this iconic tavern that has a bartender that used to be this amazing adventurer that has settled down and has a tavern with a giant hole in the center of it that leads to the Underdark, which is great. And the time and effort they put into creating this tavern for you, I may not use anything from the dungeons in this book, but I really want to put the Yawning Portal Tavern into my game because it's great. It has so much flavor. Their description of Durin, the bartender, is phenomenal, and he's such an interesting character. They give you rollable tables for how to introduce a dungeon or quest to your party, giving the quest giver potentially ulterior motives or just a reason why they're approaching the party in the first place. So definitely don't skip the introduction on this, because the Yawning Portal Inn is a great addition to this book and honestly one of the highlights for me of the book. Now, going into the first dungeon that they gave us, the Sunless Citadel, which is a 3rd edition dungeon, it's set to be first level and take your party up through 3rd level. Now, a lot of this is going to be opinion based, because as those of you that listen to the show know, or those of you that listen to Eberron Renewed, the actual play podcast that I do with Philip and a couple other guys, I love narrative based campaigns. I'm not the type of guy that enjoys running, just go kill the bad guy, get the treasure, get out of Dodge. I want there to be plot hooks. I want there to be plot threads, political machinations, things of that nature. And so the city of Oakhurst, which is the first thing you get in the Sunless Citadel, left me wanting a lot more. It's a pretty bare bones description of the town. There's no map to it. There's very few NPCs given any description. I really wish they would have taken at least one, ideally two or three NPCs in Oakhurst and given them the same love and attention they did to Durin, the barkeep of the Yawning Portal Inn, because there's just not a whole lot to go on with this village. It's very generic. Having said that, once you get into the dungeon, the storytelling is really great. throughout the majority of the dungeon. You have this interesting feud going on between the kobolds and the goblins. You can actually potentially ally yourselves with one of the sides. You get the return of Meepo, the kobold dragon keeper, who is just this kind of iconic figure from D&D editions past. So it's great to see him make his grand arrival in 5th edition. There's some interesting infighting going on amongst the goblin tribes that you can really get into. And the dungeon itself has a lot of history built into its design. They make it very clear that this is an old, ancient place that was not built by the kobolds or the goblins. There's a lot of stuff going on here. And they do a good job of presenting that information in such a way that it's easy for you to convey it to your players. And there's also in room 37, for you dungeon masters listening and you want to skip ahead, room 37 has an awesome little hook leading you straight into the Forge of Fury, the next dungeon in the book. So it gives you that nice little progression. And I never read the Sunless Citadel back when it was in 3rd edition, so this may be a holdover because the Forge of Fury was written as a follow-up to the Sunless Citadel, so it may just be a carryover from that. But I love the little hook that'll make your players intrigued by the Forge of Fury dungeon if you want to continue on to it. Now, once you get past that initial level, sadly, it gets a little bit boring to me once you hit the Grove level of the dungeon. It becomes much more of a straightforward, head to the boss fight, kill him, get your loot, and get out style of dungeon. And the bad guy's motivations are pretty bland and generic, so that left me wanting a little bit more. Now, overall, I think the Sunless Citadel is a great dungeon for starting out a campaign. It's got lots of hooks once you're into the dungeon, linking you back to Oakhurst. Lots of great stuff going on with the kobolds, the goblins, and even potentially druidic circles, because your bad guy is a druid with the moniker The Outcast. So there's some great stuff that you can build off of there going into the rest of your campaign. The fortress level of the dungeon where you start out is top-notch, great storytelling. The Grove level is a bit too straightforward for my personal taste, and I would recommend if you were going to use this dungeon to alter some of it to make the Fates of the Lost Adventurers that came before you more interesting, because it's kind of boring what ended up happening to them, and perhaps giving the Outcast a more interesting motivation or perhaps even making him sympathetic. Having said that, this is your first level dungeon, so if you just want to present the game to your players as written, that's perfectly fine. You don't need a lot of plot hooks right from the outset moving forward. Now, moving on to the Forge of Fury, which is a third level adventure. It should take your players all the way up through 5th level. It's a good generic dungeon to just insert into any setting. It's got a really good premise that can just be plug and play style. As long as your setting has dwarves and it has orcs, then you can literally stick it in there. Even if dwarves are extinct, because this is supposed to be an ancient dungeon, that will still work. So yeah, definitely take this and plug it in anywhere in your campaign, as long as it's level appropriate, obviously. Another thing that I really like about it is there's multiple options for player entry. Creative players could even get all of the treasure with doing maybe 1% of the work that the dungeon intends for them to do to get it. Now, if any of my players were this miraculously creative and managed to pull it off, I would probably think they had a copy of this book sitting on their shelf somewhere. But there are players out there that would be able to kind of work around things and see it from a different angle that you wouldn't expect and skip most of the dungeon. So that's pretty cool that they offer that option to you. Now, as far as the dungeon itself, it's a pretty straightforward murder hobo style of dungeon. Kill the orcs, kill the dragon, get the treasure, get out. It has some interesting potential once you get to the lower levels with the Duergar, where you can resolve some stuff via non-combat, which I really enjoy having those multiple paths to victory kind of thing. And there is a rich history that they have for the Foundry level of this dungeon. However, they don't do it as well as they did it in the Sunless Citadel, where a lot of those things were just done in such a way to where it was easy to convey to the players. Whereas in the Forge of Fury, there will be statues and it will give you this wonderful description of who this person was. But literally anybody that would have known this person is dead, and there's no way for you to convincingly convey that information to your players. So that was kind of a letdown, just giving you that information, but no way to let your players in on the awesome lore of this dungeon, unless you have a dwarf historian in your party. And the dragon encounter, the final boss fight for this dungeon, the way that they have written it, it is going to be downright difficult, even potentially frustrating with the tactics they've written for this dragon. I would recommend probably taking those tactics and pushing them back to once the dragon is at half hit points or something like that. So your players can have that really satisfying cinematic fight with the dragon, and then they have to get their gears turning and really think about the fight rather than having them have to be in that mode for the entire fight. Because I could see myself getting frustrated with the fight after the eighth round of the dragon doing the same thing over and over, which is admittedly the smartest thing for it to do, but it's not very cinematic. It's not a whole lot of fun. Overall, it's a decent dungeon. It's great for a group focused on killing stuff and getting the treasure. Could potentially be a nice diversion for a more narrative-driven campaign. If you've been going nonstop levels 1 through 3, focused on your narrative and focused on your story that you're wanting to tell, this would be a good little break to give the players. Have them find some information about this ancient dwarven stronghold and orcs have taken it over, and have them go investigate it. And let them just have fun killing orcs, killing dragons, getting treasure, those iconic things that D&D is all about. And then once they're done with that, go back to your story. I think your players would really enjoy that kind of breathing room from a more narrative-heavy campaign. The next dungeon in the book is the Hidden Temple of Tomoa Chen, which I might be saying wrong, but that's how I'm going to go with it. And there's going to be a lot of names in this review for this particular dungeon that I'm probably going to butcher. They give you phonetic ways to say it in the book, but even those can sometimes be hard to vocalize. So bear with me and let's get into it. It's a 5th level adventure. It doesn't indicate the ending level like the previous two adventures did, but I'm going to guess it's going to take your characters up through probably 8th level, because that's the recommended starting level for White Plume Mountain, and thus far all of these dungeons have led into each other nicely, so that's what I'm going to guess. Once again, like with the Forge of Fury, this is definitely a plug-and-play style of dungeon. There's no town given, there's no real lead-in given to you on how to get your players there. It just presents the dungeon as is, and it's up to you as the dungeon master to get them there. So that makes it very easy to insert into any campaign. It just involves a little bit more work on your end as the dungeon master. The thing that I love about this dungeon, and it was really notable back when it first released for, I think it was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, it was the first dungeon that had a break from the normally Tolkien-esque European feel that D&D is really known for. This is an Aztec Mayan-influenced dungeon, and that just permeates all of it, and it's an awesome break. If you present this dungeon to your players in a more Tolkien-esque style of campaign, it's going to feel alien, it's going to feel ancient, it's going to have a really good feeling to them, and they're going to be feeling very much like fish out of water in this scenario, because they will have not dealt with anything like this dungeon before. Some of the other notable things that you get from this dungeon that just made me sit up and get really excited when I read them was Kalkakila, which is a giant hermit crab that can talk to the party. Tekuzit Tekadl, which is the Lord of Snails. He's actually a giant slug, which just that kind of skews me out a little bit. And there are monsters in this dungeon that are genuine nightmare fuel. There are some really scary things going on. They're not presented in a horror way, but once you see the picture of them, it'll make your skin crawl a little bit. The Chapel of Kulkakan is a great cinematic encounter that really has a timer to it, and your players have to really rush against the clock to get it done. And the Ulmen language, which is not a normal D&D language, it's not something presented in the player's handbook because it is supposed to be very ancient and very old. It presents an interesting obstacle for your players because none of them are going to be able to speak this language. So you're going to have somebody capable of casting a spell to comprehend this language, or as a dungeon master, if you wanted to alter it to be maybe a ancient dialect of a language that they know, just to give the players more opportunity to actually communicate with some of the things that exist in this dungeon, or even read some of the writings on the wall. That might be a good idea. That's probably what I would do, honestly, just to prevent the players from feeling like they were totally shut out from getting the whole story of this dungeon. And also, there's a game in this dungeon called Pelota Ball, which is awesome. Just go read the description of that and how to play it, and it's great. It would be so much fun in a dungeon where there's all this stress and things are trying to kill you, and then in order to get out of this room, you have to play a game, which is a lot of fun. Overall, it's an awesome dungeon to give your players. if you want them to have a sense of an ancient alien civilization that is long dead. There's no reference point for it in the modern world. And it has some great puzzles and fights that aren't a simple race to zero hit points. You really have to think through these fights and think about the type of people that you're interacting with and how you should interact to different creatures that you come across. Because some of them are good aligned creatures until you attack them, and then they'll fight back. So if you just have players that are going through killing stuff, they're going to go through a lot of fights that they wouldn't normally need to go through. Next up, White Plume Mountain, which is an 8th level adventure. Once again, no end level given, but Dead and Thay is supposed to be 9th level, so it's a very short dungeon, so probably only one level, maybe two. But once again, it's a very, very short dungeon, kind of an in-and-out sort of thing, but it is very much one of those thinking player style of dungeons. If you have a hack-and-slash style group, they're going to have a hard time with this, honestly, unless they can really flip that switch in their brain and approach it from a more thoughtful viewpoint. The room design is very inventive. You have players swinging over geysers, multi-tiered aquariums, fighting over a boiling lake. There's some really cool cinematic stuff going on in this dungeon, but it lacks any real narrative, through line, or resolution. It's very much an old school feel. There's no satisfying ending to this dungeon from a narrative standpoint. It's just, you got the treasure. So it's an interesting dungeon that requires players to think their way through it, and it lacks any real narrative elements to it. So as a DM, you're either going to need to introduce those on your own or just use this dungeon as a simple diversion, kind of like Forge of Fury, where you can allow your players to get some really awesome, frankly, iconic weapons from D&D, but not really have those strong narrative elements tied into it. Next up, we have Dead and Thay, which is a dungeon that was D&D Next playtest material that they've obviously updated and adapted to the final 5th edition rules. And it's a 9th through 11th level dungeon. It's a very robust, diverse dungeon, multiple allies to be made over the course of it. There's some strong narrative elements going on here, which is very apparent by the fact that it's the newest dungeon that was written. It really harkens to those newer ideas of how a dungeon should be run and having these various plot lines going on throughout it. And I mean, you can get a fire elemental ally in this dungeon, which if that doesn't make you want to jump into it right now, I don't know what will. What's really cool is that this dungeon is the largest in the book, hands down, and it's broken down into different themed areas. So I say that because if you just ran this dungeon as is, it's going to take 6, 7, 8 sessions potentially. There are over 100 rooms in this dungeon. So what I would probably do instead of just running the dungeon as is because they've broken them down into different themed areas that are about the size of a small to medium sized normal dungeon, I would just pull one of those. There's a abyssal dungeon. There's a predatory dungeon with just monsters. I mean, there's really something for anybody here. So you can just pull that section out, and they've organized the book in such a way to where it's broken down by those sections. So you can just pull those rooms out and use that as a dungeon. And many of the NPCs, as I was reading through this, I would get to an NPC and immediately go, I want to play that character. They really did a good job of creating some NPCs that are great character concepts in and of themselves. You have a crazy vengeance-filled Deva running around at one point, which is awesome. So yes, it's a great dungeon. I really enjoy it. I don't know how well it would do running it as written. It's one of those mega dungeons that really is old school tournament style play, but it has some new school elements with the narrative threads that go throughout it. So yeah, I would probably just pull bits and pieces from this dungeon, but overall the entire dungeon is really cool, and I could see groups running through this whole thing and having a blast doing it. And the next to last dungeon in the book is Against the Giants, which is one of the most iconic campaign arc style dungeons in D&D history. It's 11th level, at least. I mean, if you were sending 12th or even 13th level players into this dungeon, that would probably be okay. They're not going to feel overpowered at any point. And this is actually three separate dungeons linked together with a great narrative through line. It's a little bare bones, but it does have a really interesting conspiracy at the center. And this, I view as a great starting point for a Dungeon Master. Running it as is, your players will get some satisfaction out of it, but I would add some more foreshadowing and things like that to the greater conspiracy at hand, because it does feel a little out of nowhere once you get to the end and it pops up. So that's the only warning I would give with this dungeon, is you may want to add some more elements once you've read through it to kind of lead the players to where it's going. But one thing that I love about it, it's got varied locales, varied monster types. You're obviously fighting hill creatures, fire creatures, frost creatures, and it'll have the players asking questions a lot throughout about what's going on. So you don't want to lay it on too thick with the foreshadowing, because you want your players questioning, like, why are all these giants working together? Why are they attacking? And if you give too much, it'll lessen that for them. So definitely sprinkle in some foreshadowing about the greater thing that's going on, but don't lay it on too thick. Let your players ask their way through this adventure. And it could be, if you haven't yet, a great way to introduce the drow into your game and or setting, because they show up like a gunshot and you obviously do not eradicate all of them. So it would be a great moment for the players to kind of meet these alien looking creatures and continue on from there. And also, one other thing that I would recommend doing with this, if you wanted to kind of pad it out to run a little bit longer, is add some travel time between the dungeons. As it's written, the players are pretty much able to teleport from one place to another. But if you took out those elements, force them to travel, fight some enemies along the way, learn more about what's going on through that traveling, this could be a really great half of a campaign, even a whole campaign. And lastly, the Tomb of Horrors, the big one, the one that everybody's been waiting to get their hands on for 5th edition. This is pretty much what you would expect from the Tomb of Horrors. It's a high-level thinking player's style of adventure. There's not a whole lot of fighting going on. There's a whole lot of puzzles. And there are elements of this that not even your characters will be able to solve. You as a player have to figure them out. There's no dice rolling to figure out some of these puzzles, which I really enjoy. I really appreciate that. Dead and Thay had some of that as well, where it was things that you have to figure out as a person. You can't just roll a knowledge check and get the information you're looking for. Having said that, Tomb of Horrors has always been designed to be either wholly punishing for players with too much hubris about their characters, or a test of skill for players that really want to go against the ultimate dungeon. And in the second category, it kind of falls short, because there are moments where it becomes overly reliant on dice rolls. Unless the players have gone through this two or three times before and figured out what traps are where, there are going to be moments where they die simply because they roll poorly, which is fine. That's part of the game. But if you are going into the Tomb of Horrors thinking it's going to be the ultimate test for the skill of a player, then you're going to want to adapt those moments a little bit, because I would hate for a player to get to the very last room and a trap trigger, and because they rolled a one, their character dies. That has the potential to be very frustrating for that person, rather than kind of that satisfying, I almost had it kind of death. It could be frustrating. So just take that to heart. Tomb of Horrors, it's what you're expecting it to be. It is brutal. The amount of damage these traps do to you is crazy. The amount of times you can get trapped to starve to death is crazy. If you are looking to pick up this book for Tomb of Horrors because you want that brutal dungeon that will kill your players over and over, and they have to have 4 character sheets with them for all the different characters they're bringing to the table, go pick the book up, because the Tomb of Horrors won't let you down. Now, granted, it is a little bit smaller than I think a lot of people are hoping it's going to be. It's not a true room-for-room adaptation of the original dungeon, but I wasn't really expecting it to be, given the size of the book. But having said that, you can throw this at your players. Just because it's smaller doesn't mean it's not equally as punishing. And your players are going to die in the first room. Somebody will die if they're not ready to take on the Tomb of Horrors. So definitely pick it up. So yeah, that's the whole book. obviously, towards the back of the book, they have references for the magic items and the new monsters that they've introduced throughout the adventures. I've already kind of plugged some of my highlights from the Hidden Temple of Tamoa-chan, because those were probably the most creative monsters I saw in there. And I, like I said at the top, I really enjoy this book. I think it's fun. I think it's a good resource for dungeon masters to not only pull entire dungeons, but pull ideas out of, pull a room or two out of the Tomb of Horrors if you don't want to send your players through the whole thing. I would definitely recommend going and picking this book up, reading through it, gaining that inspiration, and running with it. Because that's the thing that these books do really well, is even if you are the type of person that wants to homebrew your own campaign, homebrew your own setting, use these books as inspiration. Because, not saying these people can do it better than you, but any resource that you can have only makes your game that much stronger. And I think Tales from the Yawning Portal is an excellent addition to any Dungeon Master's collection of books and resources to utilize. So yeah, let me know what you guys think about the book. Let me know when you picked it up, what you thought about it, which dungeons were your highlight. Probably my favorite dungeon coming out of this one was the Hidden Temple of Tamoa-chan, the one that I can't pronounce, because it was so different. It was so unique. And I would really love to run some players through this dungeon to see how they do. But yes, definitely let me know which one was the highlight for you, which monsters you found to be the creepiest, because there are definitely some in that dungeon that just, I might eliminate them from my game just because they're a little bit too creepy for me. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. And once again, I am Eric, and thank you for listening to the Knowledge Check Podcast.